On Point, hosted by Peter Van Aartrijk. Conversations with interesting and informative experts on technology, branding, culture, social media marketing, and other great topics.
Hello again, everybody. I'm Peter Van Aartrijk, your host for On Point, a podcast brought to you by our good friends at Wells Media, which includes Carrier Management, Insurance Journal, and other publications. And today I'm pleased to have with us Jennifer Byrne. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
And Jennifer's company is, you're welcome, thank you, I should say. The company that we're going to talk about mostly here is pronounced Qesne. It is, the URL is QUESNAYS.com, QUESNAYS.com. And we're going to talk about that and a lot of other stuff. Jennifer, I thought because you have a rich background in branding, I should say, I know you've launched a lot of products and things. I love talking about brand. I love talking about InsurTech, so we're going to do all that. But first, could you go into a little bit about your background and what brought to you where you're at today?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So quick background on me is that I grew up and had the good fortune to start traveling, exploring the world at a young age. Upon graduating Duke University, decided that I would move abroad and move to Rome, Italy, where I joined a startup television company and thought that I could not only learn a little bit about the world and how to work in a multicultural environment, but also really dive into an industry that I found interesting, being media, and then the combination of technology with that, being one of the world's first global satellite TV companies called Orbit. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful experience there, came back to the U.S., stayed in the media industry, worked at CBS Television, which was distributing broadcast content around the world to a variety of cable and satellite TV providers. And while at CBS, I started to think about, well, how else might we be able to distribute content? And what was super interesting back then was my colleagues at CBS said, well, we'll never put video on the internet. And so that was a moment in time where I said, I might want to switch gears and go work at what now became very well known as the term startup. But back then we weren't really calling it that. So I went to work for an interesting broadband video startup that believed that consumers would start watching video on their computer screens. I learned an incredible amount about content distribution and rights. And from there, started to look ahead at mobile and thought, well, as people are starting to consume video and content online, this notion of a cellular phone looks like it could be kind of an interesting place to understand and consume content and who knows what. So investigated what was called then the wireless industry and ended up going to a startup that was creating and distributing mobile content. And back then it was in the form of SMS messages, what were called WAP games, like WAP games, and very light forms of content. And then from there was recruited by Verizon to run their video service on the 3G network, and then subsequently was tapped to launch the 4G services that a lot of which you now see today, and was really encouraged to think outside the box and started there at Verizon, the innovation program, which will become important for the rest of this conversation. But what I learned at Verizon was that there was a tremendous opportunity to try to think about how we might monetize the mobile network and bring new services and content and other value add to customers. And in doing so, was super excited about what I was seeing in that we started building relationships with Silicon Valley, and I started looking at how startups might disrupt telecom and how they might also be great partners. And so part of what I learned there was that partnerships matter, communication matters between large incumbents and startups, and the notion of creating really clear processes and fair deals was so critical to being able to launch groundbreaking things back then, which was, for example, putting YouTube on a mobile phone, which had never been done before, launching Skype over a carrier cellular network, which had not been done either. And so there were a lot of interesting challenges that we overcame, and I was really energized in the amount of technology could enable new experiences. So we looked at financial services, and from there was recruited by American Express to help with partnerships and looking at investments in startups to really launch Amex into the digital native world and really trying to connect with future card members in a very digital-centric way. And that was a terrific experience, one of the best marketers in the world. And in summary, having spent half of my career at startups, half at corporate, I decided to co-found Kesne with the goal of bridging the gap between large corporations and startups and really trying to drive innovation through partnerships. And that's what we do today.
Okay. Yeah, I assume the guy who said there wouldn't be streaming over the internet has had a glorious and short career at Blockbuster. Is that what happened to him?
Probably.
When you first started talking, I didn't catch where you said you were born. It was, and where else you were before you went to Rome. I want to make sure the listeners hear that too.
Yeah, I grew up in Westchester County, a suburb of New York City, and then graduated from Duke University in North Carolina.
Okay. All right. So here we are. The reason we're chatting is because you do have quite a bit of experience in a number of financial services and other industries, businesses, but insurance is one of them, and that's how we came to be talking here today. Let's talk about, how did you get to create this company? What led you to become somebody who wanted to, because you talked a lot about partnerships as you explained your career, and working for the man, I guess you kind of develop, if you're looking to grow, you know, partnerships are important. Now you're at a company, Kesne, which is apparently all about these connections and partnerships. So what led to this creation? And maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the name of the firm means and what you do there.
Sure. So I think what I learned and observed by working at both startups and large corporations was that there was so much opportunity that was not realized due to lack of communication, understanding, creating win-win deal structures, and also understanding what you're good at and what you're not good at. So, for example, at large companies, they tend to be very good at innovating on the core and continuing to add, for example, you know, moving from 3G to 4G in the telecom world, and now we're into 5G. That's core infrastructure, highly operational, strategic in certain areas. But at the end of the day, large incumbents struggle to in-house develop new products and services to meet the demands of a changing customer base and multi-segment customer base. And so when we started looking at how we might be able to do that, when I was at Verizon, I really saw that a lot of the new ideas and the tech knowledge and know-how and nimbleness and flexibility in getting things done really was coming from Silicon Valley at the time. So there were startups really just breaking new ground. And so what I learned over the years of working in this sort of partnership role was sometimes startups didn't have the right understanding of the incumbent's business. So that was one challenge. Another challenge was just unrealistic expectations that a large corporation can make a pilot investment or partner decision in fewer than, you know, 9 to 12 months, let's say, on average. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of on the startup side. And then on the corporate side, what I learned to do, and we still coach individuals today to do, is to set the right expectations and map process to the risk at hand. So for example, large corporations, if you're interested in innovating and you want to launch a new product, whether it's with an insurtech or a fintech, sending a 40-page NDA or master services agreement may not be what's required to run a pilot. Taking a year to do due diligence on a $100,000 investment, you're going to miss out on opportunities. So what we saw was an opportunity to manage a more efficient process so that startups and large corporations each benefit and drive towards a new product or new service launch or a new customer experience. And that's what we're really all about.
Okay. I think you're also about helping women entrepreneurs. Can you perhaps unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, so when we go about bridging this innovation gap, we are primarily setting up programs, processes, and actionable strategies for large corporations to help them identify, partner, and work with the right startups. And one way that we do that is by running innovation competitions, and that's a very public way of soliciting great ideas, startups, technology, talent, so that the large corporations and sponsors can take a look at a consistently evaluated set of startups and identify where there might be investment, partner, or launch opportunities. Over the initial 4 years of running KESNE, we noticed that when we were running a transportation innovation competition or education, healthcare, broadcast, fintech, the vast majority of our applicants from the startup ecosystem were male. And so we thought that there was something wrong given that women start the majority of new businesses and many other interesting statistics. So we looked at finance and insurance and thought, well, there's a lot of opportunity to innovate. There's some big challenges and there's a lack of diversity. So why not launch what became known as Female Founders in FinTech and Female Founders in InsurTech to not only bridge this innovation gap, but bridge the diversity gap as well. And so with Female Founders, FinTech, and InsurTech, we've invited women from around the world who have startups that are transforming insurance and finance to apply via our online portal and subsequently obtain mentorship, education, visibility, capital, prizes, and other benefits. And at the same time, our corporate sponsors and clients get the benefit of not only seeing incredible talent in startups, but coming from a diverse set of founders, namely women in this case. And so the program has been a terrific success. We now have actually 700 women-led startups in our ecosystem that are in some form transforming or digitizing insurance and finance and mobility. And that really cuts across a range of insurance products and financial products, and they come from 60 countries, which is pretty exciting too. So the program is growing. We're actually going to be launching our Female Founder InsurTech fourth year edition late June this year.
Okay. So I got lots of questions for you. So this is probably a terrible question coming from a guy, but I feel like I got to ask it. So they're underrepresented in terms of entrepreneurs, female entrepreneurs in the insurtech space, and you mentioned financial services as well. What is it? So you have this incredible forum, it sounds like, and I'd love to hear some examples of how it has worked for specific startups. But is there something unique about the how women in general approach the startup? Task. Is there something? Again, I don't want to sound really stupid, like gender stupid here, but it seems like there's an incredible opportunity with 52% of the world being female. Obviously, you have that opportunity, but you also have just a different approach, maybe more collaborative. I'm just speculating, but that's sounds exactly what you're look, I'm on your website now. It sounds what that's all about is collaborating, partnerships. Women are really good at that, really good. And I've seen at InsurTech Connect some of these women speaking, and it's just astonishing, really. Why were they not coming forward, A, and B, is there anything different about women-led startups?
Yeah, I think a lot of women were starting companies, but perhaps we weren't hearing much about them due to a lack of visibility or funding, and in some cases, just pure networking. So when you look at some of the challenges that women-led startups face, it is unfortunate that although there was a tiny bit of progress last year, still only 2.8% of venture capital goes to women-led startups.
Wow.
Which doesn't really seem...
Did you say 2.8%, Jennifer?
Yes, 2.8%.
Oh, wow. That's low. Jeez. Okay.
Yeah, so there's a funding gap, which is slowly starting to be addressed in a couple of ways. One is that there's an increasing number of investors who are women, which we didn't see so much in the past. And so there's more funds being raised by women who are investing in other women. Okay. Which I think is a nice trend. Additionally, there's a better understanding that actually diverse boards, diverse founders actually do drive better ROI and results. That includes performance on the S&P. That includes return on the dollar invested. That includes board performance. So I think as we see more positive tangible metrics come out, I think we'll start to see some change and improvement. Part of what we also have heard from our women founders in our ecosystem is that aside from the funding, 47 to 48% cite the lack of mentorship as a real hurdle and hindrance to their scaling up their business. So without the network, the right introductions, whether that be within a large corporation or to an investor, you're really held back. And so part of our program is very much focused on mentor-mentee mapping, coaching, mm-hmm. access, visibility, speaking. So it's not only that, you know, those opportunities need to be made available to women, but at the same time, women also have to step up and raise their hand and say, yes, I want to go on stage and that will take that speaking opportunity. So that's also part of the training, I guess, and confidence building that needs to happen. I think the other thing that we've learned is that a lot of investors like to invest in products and people that they can relate to. And so if the vast majority of investors are male, statistically, that's also partly why they're investing in other men. But again, that's starting to change as the diversity among investors evolves, and then also the just awareness that it's actually a great business opportunity to invest in diverse founders.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Thank you for that. Okay, my daughters have some questions for you. You ready?
Okay.
And one of them you actually just sort of brought up, and that is about mentorship. How do you become a mentor, and where do you find a mentor? One of the questions they had for you.
So me personally or in general?
Yeah, I think both, either.
Okay. Yeah, so personally, I was very fortunate to have found mentors along my career journey. And candidly, two of them were men, and if it weren't for them, I probably wouldn't have accomplished what I did because they were giving me the leeway, the flexibility, the creativity, and the confidence just to try new innovative approaches and really push the envelope. So I was fortunate that I found them before any sort of formal notion of mentorship existed in corporate speak. Now it's a more formalized aspect of corporate work, and I think that's a good thing. I think there are a lot of internal training programs. There are even performance objectives, I think, now in place in a lot of corporations, where there's not only the objective to maybe coach an up-and-coming leader or participate in groups such as a women's leadership group or something else that's maybe outside of your day-to-day interaction. So I think there's formal and informal groups and ways to get access to coaches and mentors. And then I think there are a lot of interesting organizations and programs that an entrepreneur can find through whether our program or other accelerators like Techstars and others. So I think there's a lot more access, and I think there's a willingness, certainly in the U.S., for leaders and executives to spend time coaching. And so that is a really critical part of our program, because without that, a startup founder will struggle with questions that they don't really need to struggle with. And so if they can have a little bit of a guide, you know, how to make decisions in a large corporation, how do I better position my pitch deck for a corporate VC, or how do I scale my business with the employees that I have? And so it's really important to understand what the mentees need, because it's also not all the same thing. So we are also in our program just careful to do a good job mapping sort of capabilities to needs.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine you are mentoring other people now, since you've got so much experience in your career. And what sorts of things, I mean, obviously there's the forum, there's money, capital, help with a pitch deck or whatever, that sort of thing. But on a kind of emotional level, what are some things you say to young entrepreneurs that to make them feel like they can keep it all together and keep working and persevere and those sorts of things?
Yeah, some of the advice that I've received and therefore I've passed along, which has been, I think, helpful to me is, one is surround yourself with either an informal or formal advisory board that might bring a different perspective or a set of skills that will complement what you're comfortable doing. So I think having that like little tribe, I think is very important, and it's been incredibly valuable to me. I'm very fortunate that I have a lot of great advisors. The other thing, especially for women, is raise your hand, volunteer to speak at conferences, events, even if you're not 100% expert on the topic, that's okay. If you have something tangible about your business, a case study, knowledge to share that's relevant to that speaking engagement, there's a correlation between job applications and even what we see in our competition, in that a lot of recruiting firms have cited statistics that women won't apply to a job unless they have 8 of the 10 requirements, and their male counterparts will apply if they have, you know, 4 of the 10. And so we see that in the innovation competition process, trying to encourage women to apply to programs like ours to learn and grow and get these sort of introductions and advisors. And we've had to convince some of the women to apply, because they've said, well, I'm not exactly ready, or my PowerPoint isn't perfect. And so we've even had to encourage them to, quote, show up. And that's half of the battle, right?
Right.
And so I think it's showing up, obviously being prepared, knowing your stuff, getting that advisory board set. And then lastly, for any entrepreneur, not just women, I think it's make sure that you're solving a problem that needs to be solved. Spend time talking to customers and doing customer validation. I think regardless of the service or product that you believe in, make sure that it's validated with within the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. And that's why you see so many insurtechs pivot, because they're like, oh, we're going after the wrong problem to solve. We have to do this over here. You see that where InsurTechs, for example, will try to cut out the agent and broker when, in fact, including them makes a lot more sense. Not for every InsurTech, but many of them have found that to be the case. So it's you're right, the validation. Okay, another question from the ladies, if you don't mind. This one, again, it's these are fun questions. What advice would you give to a young female entrepreneur who is considering quitting her full-time job to pursue her passion? Losing that security and consistent paycheck can be scary, especially when you don't know if it will pay off in the long run.
Well, it's definitely not for everyone. So I would say, you know, think about not only what you're passionate about doing, but it kind of goes back to what problem are you trying to solve? And if you validated that on some level, then go for it. Find the right problem to solve, the right team. That's very, very important. Find the right team that you want to be a part of and go for it. You can always go back and get a new role somewhere else or pivot or reinvent oneself. But I would say in the U.S., the good thing is that risk is rewarded, and I think you learn a lot even if you fail in your first or second startup. I think there are a lot of success stories, a lot of founders that would share that kind of feedback, and you learn the most from those kinds of experiences. But it does take a little bit of courage, I guess, to forego that paycheck. And I think if you stay focused on that problem and the team dynamic, I think you can find your way to success.
Okay. Well, how would you, I know that you're involved in a number of industries, you know, speaking of industry events, I know it's something you do. You run competitions. You are a superior networker, clearly. Where do you, and so you probably run into a lot of different startups and insurtechs and fintechs. Where, on the insurtech side, InsurTech Connect, for example, a large conference in Las Vegas, hopefully it'll happen in 2020, in person anyway. There's all kinds of entrepreneurs there that are working on life insurance, health insurance, business, personal lines, all kinds of different sides of the business and segments and niches and things. As you look back and your involvement there, there's been this shift again from sort of everybody running around with all these crazy ideas. So most of them aren't going to work out. Many will. There's been this shift where large, you mentioned incumbents, status quo incumbents have changed their tune to say, yeah, we need to work with these folks, where the startups have been coming around and saying, all right, we need to partner to make this thing work. It's not just the money and the funding, it's are we going to get any traction? Do you think we're at the point now where it's more of a formalized relationship, or will we continue to see some bright ideas that might disrupt the status quo? Because the status quo hasn't changed a heck of a lot. You still have a lot of insurance organizations that are trying to become more nimble, but it's taken a while.
Yeah, and I guess there's pros and cons to maybe what's happening right now with the COVID-19 crisis and financial crisis happening, that the insurers and the banks were catapulted into digital transformation overnight. So whether it's a remote workforce being set up, mobile banking, or insurance companies finding digital ways to serve customers where the phone lines are overwhelmed, the need to be online or mobile has become paramount. And so whether it's processing claims or sharing documents, just digitization of everything is so fundamental. And we all knew that, but I think the crisis has really driven that home in a good way. And so there may be opportunity to innovate more around these essential areas and continue this great momentum. And that might include things like, as you pointed out, it's not an all or nothing, you know, totally outside of the box or in, where you disintermediate, for example, you know, the use of chatbots. How can an insurer better utilize a chatbot that has some sort of the automation aspects for core sort of FAQ environment, but then hand that off to the agent at that right moment in time to address the issue or process the transaction. So I think what we're hearing is that essential innovation is really what's going to be most important with an insurtech. So are they a tech company that can enable more digital experiences and therefore reduce costs, candidly, not only about revenue? There can be a lot of interesting innovative efficiencies that can come through working with insurtechs, and really focusing on near-term needs versus perhaps that 24, 36-month out innovation projects. It sounds like, from what we're seeing, if you can solve a more essential need, you will get the attention of an insurer or an investor, and versus the more experimental, exploratory insurtechs that maybe were a little bit more popular over the last year. I think the pragmaticism of insurtech will probably become more apparent, and we'll probably see that at InsurTech Connect. We're seeing that entrepreneurs are also pivoting a little bit to say, well, my technology does X, and maybe it's an AI solution. And they were thinking about maybe 2 to 3 use cases. Well, now in a COVID and post-COVID world, how can that entrepreneur apply that AI solution in new forms and use cases? So I think that'll also be interesting to see how the enablers show up and how they can help carriers and reinsurers in new ways. I think it's also going to be challenging for the more exploratory insurtechs to get the attention of insurers in the short term. But there's ample opportunity to digitize and transform, and whether that's enabler or it's new products and services, is it more pandemic or parametric related insurance? If it's cyber focused, I would suspect that there's a lot more attention being spent at looking at how to address the cyber risk that we now have by moving to digital, whether it's on the employee or the customer side. So I think there's definitely going to be some really interesting startups emerge, I think, and new use cases emerge from this period of time.
Okay, Jennifer, thank you. Jennifer Byrne is co-founder and president of Quesnay. It's Quesnay.com. And we'll stay in touch with you, Jennifer. I hope that we do get to meet in person on the circuit in 2020. Who knows, with business travel or travel period happening, but I'm hopeful. I never thought I would say that I miss travel. I told an airline, I was on the phone with somebody, I said, I'm not going to complain about missing bags again. It's good to go see people, but I think in the meantime, folks, if they have interest in what you're doing, go to your site and learn a little bit about what you have going on. And we'll stay in touch with you. I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Peter. I really enjoyed the conversation and the great questions that your daughters asked as well. And look forward to meeting you in person soon.
This has been On Point with Peter Van Aartrijk, a podcast presentation of Wells Media Group.